can agree that working for social change takes passion. And Bettina Love has that and more.
How can we be abolitionists again? How can we take risks for other people's children again?
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to Dr. Love about abolitionist teaching, both in and out of the classroom. We'll also open up a time capsule and spend an academic minute with women in politics. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Bettina Love is an abolitionist. Born and raised in Rochester, New York, she began teaching elementary students in Homestead, Florida, in a school so diverse the printed permission slips were printed in English, Spanish, and Haitian Creole. She is now Associate Professor of Educational Theory and Practice at the University of Georgia and a sought-after speaker on a range of topics, including anti-blackness in schools, hip-hop education, black girlhood, queer youth, art-based education to foster youth civic engagement, and issues of diversity and inclusion. In her new book called We Want to Do More Than Survive, Abolitionist Teaching and the Pursuit of Educational Freedom, she draws on her life's work of teaching and researching in urban schools and argues that educators must teach students about racial violence, oppression, and how to make sustainable change in their communities through radical civic initiatives and movements, fighting what she calls the educational survival complex. And we'll get into that in a bit. I spoke to Dr. Love about why she took on this project.
You know, there's so many things happening in our society today, and oftentimes education is floating around these conversations around inequality, around racism, around sexism, around homophobia and transphobia and Islamphobia, and we kind of hope and pray that our students and our teachers are not impacted by that. And so I wanted to write a book that says, no, they're impacted by this. And I wanted to write a book that tried to really say how people are feeling, myself and others included. And so the book really tries to get at those issues around racism in education, around homophobia in education and immigration issues, and not to shy away from that and to say that if it's happening in the outside of the school building, it's also happening inside of the school building. And what are we going to do about it?
This is such a personal story. Let's start with Rochester. What did that city, or growing up in that city, how did it shape you?
Well, first and foremost, you know, to be an upstate New Yorker is to walk around with a chip on your shoulder. Because the one thing about being an upstate New Yorker is that you're not New York. And so whenever someone says, where are you from? You say New York. And they say, oh, Bronx, no. Queens, no. Albany, no. And so I wanted to write about home, a place that is oftentimes forgotten when we talk about New York. And so I wanted to talk about the beauty of growing up in upstate New York. And then second, I wanted to talk about what it meant to grow up in upstate New York in the 80s, when there were jobs and communities and schools and black teachers. And, you know, most people don't know that Rochester is the home of Eastman Kodak, the hub and headquarters of Bosch Alam and Xerox and Paychex and Wegmans. And what it meant to grow up there as a young kid was to see a flourishing black community, to be in a community where folks had jobs and folks cared about each other. And, you know, everybody raised you. You weren't just your mother's child. You were everybody's child. And so I wanted to have a conversation, and I wanted to talk about what it meant to matter. I think right now we're in a moment where we're saying Black Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter. But I wanted to say, well, what does that mean to matter? And for me, it was growing up in Rochester, New York. It was growing up in a place that I mattered as a young kid, where my community members, where teachers, where activists saw me And they wanted to see me and see all of me and see me as a little black girl in Rochester, New York, who was smart, who was intelligent, who was talented, who was thoughtful. And so for me, that's what it means to matter. It means to be in your community, and your community loves you and they protect you.
And as you were growing up and going to school, you met a fourth grade teacher named Mrs. Johnson. How did she impact you?
So, you know, my parents are Southern. My mother's family is from South Carolina, and my father's family is from Jacksonville, Florida. But they're not, I didn't really know anybody that was Southern. I just knew Southern people. And so when I first met Miss Johnson, I walked into the classroom, and this was this tall, and I was tall, and she was skinny, and I was skinny. And she was this wonderful, beautiful black woman who just was so stern and so thoughtful and so loving, but who took nobody's mess. And she was from New Orleans, and she had this accent. And I was just mesmerized by her because she was someone who I wanted to be. She was like this role model I didn't know I have. But what Ms. Johnson did for me, other than just being representation, she showed me how you love someone. She showed me how that you not just love a child because they're in their classroom, but you love a child because of their culture. And you also love a child because their success is tied to yours. And not in ideal of merit, pay, or accountability, but my success as a black child was tied to her success as a black woman teacher. She wanted to see me succeed like she wanted to see her kids succeed. And I just felt this sense of love and urgency, but also this sense of responsibility being in Ms. Johnson's classroom and how much she loved me and how much she thought of me. And I wanted to live up to her expectations where I never wanted to do that before in a classroom. It was really a turning point for me being a young person.
Well, let's get into the actual crux of the book and the one term that is in the title that really, I think, catches the eye. It's abolitionist teaching. Describe that. Just how, if you have to do a quick thumbnail on what that is. Is that even possible?
So, yeah, I'll try. So what I meant by abolitionist teaching is that there was a time in this country where folks who didn't even know each other, black folks, brown folks, Latinx folks, Native American folks, they took risks for each other. They wanted to abolish slavery. And so they took risks. And they decided that they were going to open up their homes, they were going to open up their farms, they were going to open up their wallets. And they were going to try to abolish this thing called slavery. They were going to try to work for a better humanity and a better United States of America. And so what I wanted to do was to talk about what they did and how they did it and what was special about what they did and how we as Americans right now can start to do that type of work. How can we be abolitionists again? How can we take risks for other people's children again? How can we take risks for our country again to make it a better place? And so that's what abolitionist teaching means for me.
Is it actually going on in places in the country?
Of course. Of course. Wherever there is oppression, people will rise up and people will find ways to create beautiful communities. So if you look in places like Chicago, you look in places like Rochester, New York, look at places like Atlanta, you have activists all over the country who are trying to find ways to build humanity. If you look at Atlanta, Georgia, and you go to the bailout movement that you have happening in Atlanta, Georgia, you saw last Mother's Day, activists like Mary Hooks say, we're going to bail out mamas. You know, this is ridiculous that people are sitting in jails for nonviolent crimes. And they're only sitting in jails because they can't pay bail money. They haven't done anything. And sometimes many of these folks are innocent. And so you're looking at a country right now, and you have activists that are on the ground who are making strides to make this place a better place for everyone. And so doing away with bail is just one of these movements that's happening around the country. And so that's abolitionist work. I mean, that's actually freeing people. That's abolitionist work that activists that are doing all around the country, like Mary Hooks here in Atlanta.
You go back in time a little bit and talk a lot about the work of Ella Baker. Talk about her. Who was she?
So Ella Baker was an abolitionist. She was a community organizer. She was a strategist. And she was one of those individuals that understood the power of people. She was able to, we talk about the civil rights movement and we talk about people like Dr. Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks. And rightfully so, we should talk about them. But what Ella Baker knew was that King could give the speech, but how do you get 300,000 people to the speech? You got to have organizers on the ground. And so she was the brainchild of these organizations that were truly about grassroots organizing. So we're going to make sure that people on the ground feel like they can be leaders in their own community. And she started this idea of participatory democracy That means that no, we're not going to have a hierarchy. Everyone is going to be given an opportunity to make decisions about their life, and we're going to find solidarity. We're going to compromise, but we're going to leave with ideas that make the world better for everyone. And it's going to be part of democracy, and everybody's going to participate. And she was a grassroots organizer that really was able to energize young people and get them thinking about their world and get them reading. Ellen Baker would have reading groups. She would have speaker series. She would have folks signing petitions and writing petitions and doing the work. And she wanted to take your talents that you had in your community and use them for good. Ella Baker was an unbelievable organizer. And I talk about her in the book as an example of how we can do this work as educators and as teachers and as human beings for a better tomorrow, for a more just world.
Talk about what you mean by the educational survival complex and how this is an integral part of your entire story.
Yeah, so, and I'm watching and I'm looking at education, and then I'm also trying to parallel that to the prison industrial complex. And so in the prison industrial complex, you have all these corporations, all these entities who are making money off the idea that black and brown people are corrupt, that they are thugs, that they are criminals. And this mentality moves throughout and it permeates throughout our society. And so telephone companies, food companies, bail companies, all of these companies now start to make billions of dollars off the idea that black folks and brown folks need to be criminalized in this country. The same thing is the educational survival complex. The idea that black and brown children cannot learn, that they are deficient, and so everyone's making money off that. The testing industry, the surveillance industry that goes into school and says we need to have metal detectors, we need to have guns, we need to have dogs in schools, we need to test these kids. All of these individuals are making money off the idea that black and brown kids should be taught just for their survival, never to thrive. And so what I try to do in the book is I try to go through all these examples from Native Americans and how they were taught in schools, that they were taken from their family, put in boarding schools only to survive education. English-only education, that didn't start in 2000, that started in the 1800s. This country has segregated schools for Japanese and Koreans. And so we have to make sure that we understand that whenever folks of color have tried and demanded to educate their own children, that did not go over well. And so this idea that we are stuck in perpetual survival mode, and I also argue in the book to be black, to be a person of color, is to live in perpetual survival mode. And our school systems mimics that. And so you look at Brown versus the Board of Education, who said that, you know what? We're going to integrate schools. Cool. That did not happen. And so what has been left? We now have apartheid schools. And apartheid schools in this country is when black and brown students go to school with less than 1% of white students. And we have over 8,000 apartheid schools in this country. And so whenever black and brown children and black and brown communities and parents and teachers and lawyers and doctors and everyday people get together and say enough is enough, we are met with resistance. And all we want to do is educate our children. We are met with resistance. And it says that, hey, we will educate you to survive schooling, never to thrive in schooling. And it's a complex because everybody makes money off that. And so that's what I was really trying to get to in the book and really show just how disingenuous this idea of education can be for black and brown folks.
You also point out, though, that racism can't really be legislated away. It's a societal thing.
That's right. I was having a conversation with some folks just the other day that racism isn't everything we do. If you look at artificial technology, you know, black and brown person puts their hand under the soap to get soap and it doesn't come out. Why? Because even that technology has not registered our skin yet. It's in every single thing we do. And so, you know, we can't have a conversation about education reform, education justice, and I don't believe in any type of reform. You know, reform without educational justice is just lip service. And so we can't have a conversation about justice and equity in education without having a real conversation about racism. And so I think we jumped the gun in education. We want to talk about reform. We want to talk about equality. But we haven't had a conversation about how racism plays in our schools every single day, in our classrooms, in our principal offices, in our school boards, in our teacher education programs. Nothing. So how can we have a conversation about equity? We miss many, many steps.
One more thing you talk about in the book I really want to get to because I found it very fascinating was how character education has replaced civics education, and you think that was a mistake.
It was a mistake because we didn't address racism, right? So the idea is, why do we have to have character education? because we see students as being deficient. We see their character as lacking in something. So that's why you have character education. So if you don't see my culture, you don't see the beauty in my culture, the resiliency in my culture, you don't already see the grit in my culture, then you'll say, well, these kids are lacking something. They have to have good character. Who said that black and brown children didn't have good character? So it all goes back to this idea of how racism plays out. And so now we don't do civics. We don't teach you about protesting and voting and about ideas and how people have different ideas and we come together to find agreement. We don't do that anymore. We do character education. And when you look at the history of character education, it came out in the 80s when we have an influx of black and brown students being taught by white folks. And now you have character education. So if you trace the history, you'll see how it's deeply embedded within racism.
Our conversation with Dr. Bettina Love continues with some sound advice she got from her mother. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. Is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Dr. Bettina Love, Associate Professor of Educational Theory and Practice at the University of Georgia and author of the new book called We Want to Do More Than Survive, Abolitionist Teaching and the Pursuit of Educational Freedom. In the book, she talks about how her mother always told her to give them hell.
So in the book, I talk about how when I grew up, my mother told me every day, you know, particularly if I had a big basketball game, to give them hell. And, you know, and I wrote that in the book because I wanted people to understand what it means to raise a black child in this country. That my mother was trying to instill in me the idea that what I had, what the most important thing I had was my voice. And that I had to go out in this world and had to give this world hell. And so to be authentic, to be who I am, to be proud of who I am, to never shrink myself, was a very important thing that my mother taught me. And even as a young girl, she still tells me to this day, you give them hell. And so that's what the book is really, you know, driven out of, is this idea that, you know, you should write and you should teach and you should interview. Whatever you're doing, you should give this world hell. You should be authentic. You should be yourself. And you should demand the best of yourself. But you should also demand that people see you for your true self. And I'm really, you know, always thankful to my mother for that.
I found it interesting how it seemed in the book that you, at that young age, equated success with getting out of Rochester.
Yeah, you know, and I, some days I really wish I had a different mentality. I don't think we should be asking kids to leave their communities. I think we should be asking kids to return to their communities and make it better. So I think we have to, you know, think about that differently. So I always, you know, that was the goal when I was a kid, was to get out of Rochester. But I don't think that should be the goal anymore. I think the goal should be for kids to come back to their communities or stay in their communities and make them a better place. You know, that's how you do this work. And so I'm always mindful of telling kids, no, you know, it's not always about leaving your community. And of course you should leave. You should go see different things and experience life. But if you can, oh, come back, give back, be there, be whatever the spark you were to get you out and come back, be that for somebody else.
What kind of pushback have you gotten back from your talking and your writing?
You know, I get the emails late at night. I get, you know, the conversations and, you know, and people, you know, saying we can't focus this much on race and, you know, teachers aren't racist. And, you know, no one's trying to say that teachers are not good people. I think anybody that wants to go into the field of education, anybody who wants to say, I want to be a teacher, they want to help. They have a good heart. They have good intentions. I teach teachers. I don't think these teachers that I'm teaching are bad people. But what I do think is that when you don't know about someone's culture, then you will eventually make decisions based on your stereotypes and your biases about them. And that's very detrimental to a child. And so I think we don't have those conversations enough. So some of the pushback is that, you can't talk about teachers like this. Teachers are dedicated professionals who are giving their lives to education. You are exactly right, but we can ask them to be much better.
Let's go back to Rochester for a minute. What's the Victorious Minds Academy? How did that work?
You know, it's a wonderful program that was started by a lot of folks who were thought about really, really deeply about race and having conversations over a four-year period about race. And so what they wanted to do is really say, okay, if we understand how racism works, then we understand how racism is a part of everything we do. And so on a very small scale, let's start the Vicious Minds Academy and start having conversations in classrooms, the principal offices, the administrative offices about race. And I think it's a really good start for a school district to try to see, to try to have deliberate conversations about race and racism and how it permeates everything we do in the school district. So I really applaud, my hometown and the Rochester School District for trying to start that conversation. It's small. It's not a big thing that's happening, but that's how movements start. It's small. It's malleable. It's flexible, and we see where we go from there. So I wanted to highlight that project in the book because it really was a project that really drew on racism and wanted to have a real conversation about whiteness and racism and how it impacts black and brown students.
Well, finally, are you hopeful? Is there any hope for us?
I'm always hopeful. I think as a person of color in this country, you have to be hopeful. That's what it means to be here, is to be hopeful. So I'm always hopeful. I'm always hopeful in humanity. But more importantly, I'm always hopeful, and I'm always, I know that we can do what's right. We've seen it done before. We don't have a shortage on ideas. We don't have a shortage on people who are motivated to do this work. So I'm always hopeful. And I'm always rooting, and I know, people of color, we are creative, we are thoughtful, we are kind, we are loving. So I know I have all the reasons to be hopeful. I'm always going to bet on us.
The name of Dr. Bettina Love's new book is We Want to Do More Than Survive, Abolitionist Teaching and the Pursuit of Educational Freedom. You can read more about Dr. Love's work at BettinaLove.com. City at Albany in New York marked its 175th birthday this spring by opening up a time capsule from 1964. The Best of Our Knowledge's Dave Lucas reports.
UAlbany's Uptown campus opened in 1964 along with new dormitories. Edward Durell Stone's futuristic design inspired urban legends that the campus was originally intended to be built in distant India or Saudi Arabia. A time capsule was placed in a cornerstone of the Dutch Quad dormitory complex. Brian Fessler, past president of the Alumni Association, describes the contents.
The time capsule was created by the first students ever to live on the Uptown campus and sealed in the cornerstone of Dutch Quad, their new home. The items include a custom sweatshirt with a note explaining the unique design, the campus viewpoint booklet, school bulletins, and a note from the Dutch Quad students to future generations of UAlbany students.
More than half a century later, the school is three campuses strong, with 180,000 alumni spanning the globe. The 175th anniversary celebration began at Draper Hall on the original downtown SUNY campus, where Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan proclaimed it University at Albany Day. Later, at the Uptown campus, UAlbany President Javi Don Rodriguez joined with senior leadership, faculty, staff, students, alumni, and community members at the official opening of the time capsule.
On May 7th, 1844, the New York State Legislature voted to create the New York State Normal School. And the rest, as they say, it's history. Actually, 175 years worth of it, right? And so, there you go. Come on.
And that was followed by a birthday party.
Happy birthday, dear UAlbany. Happy birthday to us.
Rodriguez helped blow out the candles on the party cake. Rodriguez said he is optimistic about the campus's future.
We remain committed to inspire the aspiring, to create a climate where diverse voices thrive, and to support the great minds to lead the charge, challenge convention, and turn possibilities into promise.
Graduate student Bradley Hershenson is with the College of Homeland Security, Cybersecurity, and Emergency Preparedness.
You know, we're proud to be students at an R1 research institution, and it really means a lot to be here.
What do you think of this time capsule?
I think it's really great. You know, this is stuff that's indicative of academic success from a long time ago, and it's really important to look at where we came from and see where we are.
Reporting for the best of our knowledge, I'm Dave Lucas.
Women seeking and winning political office is growing, and it needs to keep growing. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
2018 was a good year for increasing the number of women in political office. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Samantha Petty, assistant professor of political science and public policy at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, examines this shift.
Despite a nearly equal number of men and women in the United States, female political representation has been and continues to be much lower than male representation at all levels of government. Currently, at the state level, the average percent of women in all 50 state legislatures is 28%. My research focuses on how institutional changes and demographic makeup can favor the emergence of female candidates and ultimately their success in state legislatures. I find that the 15 states with term limits have a greater number of women candidates running for office. Term limits create a desirable environment for potential female candidates because term limits make being a legislator a temporary, albeit part-time job. They may incentivize women to run who do not want to be career politicians but still desire to make a difference in politics. Further, my research also finds there are a particular set of district demographics that create an environment more favorable to female candidate emergence and success. This phenomena, known as women friendliness, was first researched at the congressional level and holds its ground in the states. After controlling for a candidate's party, women are more likely to run and win in districts that have more Democratic partisans, are more urban, have a more educated population with higher incomes, and a greater percentage of women in the workforce. Further, women tend to run and win in districts with greater racial diversity. The number of women in office had been rather stagnant since the late 1990s, but saw a sharp increase in the 2018 midterm elections. Women running and winning in state legislatures have received less media attention than their congressional counterparts, but Nevada, a state with term limits, now has a legislature with a majority of women. In fact, 4 of the top 10 states for women's representation have term limits. All in all, 2018 was indeed another year of the woman.
That was Samantha Petty of the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
McMinute is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. Time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledges podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barron. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barron is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.